Hello, this is Andrew Heaton, and you're listening to The Reason Podcast. You can subscribe to us on iTunes and rate and review us while you're there. I'm joined today by Nick Gillespie. Hello, Nick.
Hi, Andrew.
The Catherine Mangu Ward.
Howdy.
And Matt Welch, who's coming to us from France.
Hello.
Hello, bonjour. So there's a White House shakeup that's been going on. President Trump fired Chief of Staff Rince Priebus and is serving thereby one of the few remaining conduits he has to the old Republican establishment. Meanwhile, Attorney General Jeff Sessions might be on the chopping block because he refused to recuse himself from the Russia investigation. And over at the State Department, Politico and other sources report that Rex Tillerson is reconsidering whether or not he actually wants to stay on as Secretary of State. During the campaign, there were a few Trump apologists and proponents, Scott Adams comes to mind, who said that his frequent shuffling of campaign staff was evidence of a brilliant managerial mind responding to situations as they happened. However, at this point, looking at his staff, I have to suspect that there could just be crummy management style, that he could just be a bad person when it comes to handling staff. Nick, How much of the criticism levied at the president is warranted? And is this just incompetence? Is this malice? Is this outside forces? What's going on?
Well, I think it's a mix of Trump's actual management strategy, as has kind of become apparent not only over his presidential campaign, but over his corporate career, but also incompetence in this sense. Trump came into office promising to pass a bunch of really important legislation by the time of the first coffee break, once he took over the Oval Office. More than 100 days out, he has not signed any significant legislation. And I think that's not all his fault, but it's partly his fault. He is ADD. He has not forced anything. He will occasionally talk about priorities in the minute. Those often fade the next time that it's, a Rosie O'Donnell or Mika Brzezinski gets up in his face and he starts chasing butterflies like that. And he does not, more importantly, he hasn't worked with the Republican leadership or even his own cabinet members to really kind of focus on what would be effective policy that would go into place. Even through executive orders, he has messed up because half the time he's releasing stuff without vetting it through the people who actually know what they're doing. And, in some ways that works well for a libertarian, or at least for me, when his travel ban gets hung up because it was, the first one was so poorly worded that it didn't pass any legal muster. That's not such a bad outcome, but it does point to a serious problem that Trump doesn't seem to understand how things get done in Washington. And this isn't a question of draining the swamp or anything. It's if you want to be an effective change agent, you're going to have to work with the Republican Party and maybe some Democrats. And, for instance, with the ban on transgender soldiers serving in the military, apparently he didn't talk to anybody about that, not the Joint Chiefs of Staff, not his Secretary of Defense, not anybody. He just tweeted a policy change out, at one point, and then people are left scrambling, and the Pentagon has already said, yeah, we wouldn't be enforcing that anyway. So I think we're seeing, bad Trump here.
Rince Priebus was one of the sort of throwing the bone people to the Republican establishment when he came in. He oftentimes, at least in media, was portrayed as sort of balancing out or coming in with Steve Bannon, who represents that populist outsider element in the Trump presidency. Now Priebus is gone. Catherine, to what extent is Trump an actual Republican? Is he still part of that fold? Is he drifting more towards whatever Trumpism is?
I find myself torn specifically on this question of what does it mean when you live in a Washington where a libertarian like me feels vaguely uneasy at the total destruction of a partisan establishment, right? So Trump is not much of a Republican at the moment, in terms of his ties to the party apparatus. He is still basically pursuing a Republican policy platform. There's nothing he's doing right now that's so outside of the mainstream of what Republican voters typically favor that, you can say that ideologically he's broken from the party. But I find myself thinking a lot these days about the distinction between stability for its own sake and the sort of institutionalized and fossilized forces in Washington as forces for bad, And on the flip side of it, the incredibly high cost of political uncertainty, right? And this is something that we typically study, or I typically read studies about in third world countries. You say, okay, well, what does it mean when people can't really predict what their political leaders are going to do the next day and how it's going to impact them? And the answer, paradoxically, seems to be that people call for more government, that they want somehow to give more power to the state, and they hope to just put good actors in place. I think we're seeing that here a little bit, but I worry that people who had a healthy skepticism for the establishment in Washington in reaction to Trump's total burning down of that establishment are going to become reflexively pro-establishment. And this is something we hear when people talk about the deep state or the administrative state. And that's not good either. We also don't like that thing. But I think, you know, this notion of Trump unfettered by party concerns and also just really understaffed. They're just not normal Washington, D.C. humans hanging around him. That sounded attractive to a certain type of, well, heck, let's burn it all to the ground, even some libertarians. But I don't think it's playing out so much in the way of shaking things up and moving us in a better direction.
And you bring up bad actors, Catherine, and that's something I think a lot of libertarians are rooting for is Jeff Sessions to leave. And a few of the other people he has there. I'm no fan of Steve Bannon either. I rather like Rex Tillerson. But let's say that Rex Tillerson and Giuliani – I'm jumping ahead here. Let's say Rex Tillerson and Jeff Sessions leave. Matt, who's likely to come in and fill the vacuum? Would they be any better?
It's hard to imagine anybody being worse than Jeff Sessions. One of Rand Paul's arguments for why he voted to confirm Jeff Sessions, which I don't think was very persuasive, was that, well, the next guys could be Giuliani and it could be Chris Christie, and both of those could be arguably just as bad, if not worse. I wonder now if, you know, Sessions is being treated pretty rudely on the merits of how he's been treated by Donald Trump, not how he generally deserves in life or his very bad policy beliefs and behavior. I wonder if you're going to get much of anyone who's going to be seduced by anyone who's like in the traditional Republican Party in any sense of the word, who's going to want to pledge their loyalty to Donald Trump. That's one of the lessons I think that some people are looking at here. If you take a list of who were the first half a dozen Republicans with any kind of standing out there who decided, yeah, let's go on the Trump train. Well, that's a list of people who, unless you're like Newt Gingrich and you're just kind of a clown, Flava Flav, going in and out of Fox and Friends, defending the president, but not having any serious power, you've all been treated pretty badly here. So whoever comes in next he started off with kind of a C-League group. I think we all saw the picture over the weekend of Corey Lewandowski and Kellyanne Conway and Omarosa and Sebastian fucking Gorka, who I can say that about for reasons we'll talk about later, looking like a Reservoir Dogs. And just you sit there and think, my God, these people near the highest echelons of power. But I realize this is a scatterbrained answer to your question, but before we leave the subject of Rens Priebus and think about weeping any tears, there's a piece in Politico today that tries to portray him as, you know, that we should feel bad about this moment. And this kind of connects to what you were talking with Catherine. At the Republican convention, I believe it was on the second day, that's when they trotted out all of the establishment Republicans who decided to swallow the pill and talk about how Donald Trump needs to be the next president. Mitch McConnell came out there. Paul Ryan came out there. Rens Priebus. And the single most chilling line for me in the entire convention, even more than whatever jokes Nick Gillespie was telling me at during the Donald Trump speech itself, was Rens Priebus there talking about how Donald Trump is going to punish companies who open up shops overseas and export away American jobs. So this guy is the head of the Republican Party, at least its organizational wing, saying that for him, having a president who can excite the Republican base and win the nomination is reason enough sit there and absolutely sell down the river one of the things that was supposed to be one of the core beliefs of Republicanism. And so in that sense, Trump has done us all a favor of showing the lack of depth, the lack of philosophical consistency or anything approaching that and the bounty of opportunism within the Republican Party here. So what does that look like going forward? I think we're going to have more D-list celebrity types. Rex Tillerson himself is an outsider on foreign policy to a huge degree. And it's just clear that whatever he's doing doesn't have a lot of connection with whatever Trump is thinking. And that's just a managerial problem. And I don't know how that gets solved or who it gets solved by.
Catherine, a moment ago, you said that when there are historically situations where the government is erratic and arbitrary, that people tend to call for more government. Is that with say like with Trump and his erratic tendencies, is anybody likely to walk away from the situation and think the two-party system is bad, or that maybe concentrating power in the executive branch is bad, or do you think we're more likely to march towards statism?
I would love to say the former, and I basically believe the latter. The idea that people would look at Donald Trump and say, hey, let's give his successors less power so this doesn't happen again, is the fondest hope of my heart. And we published a piece in Reason Magazine during the transition of power, right around the inauguration, saying essentially that. Certainly, there were plenty of Republicans who did not like what Obama did, both to expand executive power and with the expansive executive powers that he awarded himself. Trump has used his own inherited executive power to roll some of those decisions back. I'm thinking here of stuff like the Dear Colleague letter to colleges about Title IX. I'm thinking about a whole bunch of other executive orders that he talked about reversing and in many cases has, to the extent that he's able. I just think it's a lesson that people really struggle to learn, because they always think, well, this guy's so bad, the next time it'll be my guy and my guy won't do bad things. This is also, as I say, the lesson in other countries, in particular in countries where there are frequent turnovers of power and the spoils system is more in evidence. The sort of idea that once you win the big prize, you get to do whatever you want and give anything you want to your friends. That is constrained in the United States, and as I think Nick said at the beginning of the podcast, a big upside for us is that Trump seems to be not very good at executing these maneuvers. For instance, the travel ban, and the other organs of government are still pretty good at saying, "Hold on a minute, there, Buckaroo, we're going to need to take a look at the fine print." But I think the general level of trust in government is very low, has been very low for a long time. It oddly does not seem to lead for calls for less government.
Yeah, I've become a lot less Whiggish in my interpretation of American history as we go on. And I think the country's weirdly becoming more Whiggish,
When you say Whiggish, yeah, what do you mean?
My understanding of Whiggish history is the idea that we are on a track moving forward and that everyone follows the same track. And it's just a question of how fast you're going. And I am now beginning to think that, no, history kind of goes in weird, erratic positions, and you can't really predict how it's going to go. And I think Trump's a pretty good evidence of that, that everyone sort of thought, at least I did, that we were going to go with Hillary Clinton and probably keep going a little bit to the left and that kind of thing.
So I think Hillary would have faced many of the same issues, perhaps not in the personnel in the White House or something like that, because she would have had more experience actually dealing with it, both as a former first lady, but also as a senator and somebody who is involved in the actual Washington political process. But she also, in certain cases, is has terrible rankings or unfavorable rankings, similar to Trump's, and she would have been facing a Republican Congress. And I think that this decades-long kind of evacuation and hollowing out of trust and confidence in government, whether it's the presidency, whether it's the Congress, even the Supreme Court, is less favorably viewed than it was 50 years ago, is a long-term trajectory that is that is based on the way that politicians and public actors have acted. It's also true that big business is not as well regarded, generally speaking, and even churches are, you know, we're in a period where people are reevaluating these major institutions, both public and private and kind of third sector. And to put a generational spin on it, because my deep, deep goal is to become the Quisling of the baby boom generation, of which I'm a part at the end. You know, this is what the baby boomers sowed. They came of age denouncing rightly all of the lies that were coming out of Lyndon Johnson's mouth every time he spoke, whether it was about Vietnam or whether it was about the impact and the efficacy of his Great Society programs. But they came in to a world, the press used to talk about the credibility gap between Johnson and the American people, between parents and youth, et cetera. And now they're playing it out. This is the end game of the baby boom generation. They did everything possible to destroy faith and confidence in American institutions, and not necessarily for bad reasons, but what they have manifestly failed to do. And certainly I think Obama, because of all of his hypocrisies when it came to things like civil liberties, when it came to things like drug use, et cetera, and even immigration policy, George Bush lying about or misleading, whether willfully or not, about weapons of mass destruction, about being a conservative while jacking up government spending and regulation. Bill Clinton, also a big liar. And these are signature baby boom presidents. Donald Trump, a baby boomer. Hillary Clinton, a baby boomer. Of course, they're widely hated because they poured acid on all sorts of stuff, and then they never rebuilt, they never put flesh back on the bones that they had kind of pulled all of the meat off of.
Great. Now old Heaton and the millennials have to put it all back together again. Thanks, baby boomers, for everything you've done.
You know, I don't think anybody's waiting for the millennials. We're skipping ahead to Generation Z, who supposedly are the greatest generation of all.
Whenever they're still in high school, everybody says they're going to be the greatest generation. They were saying that about millennials when we were you know, 2002, 2003, that we actually started talking and irritated the shit out of everybody. And now they've jumped over. I want to go back to something earlier you were talking about, Nick. You brought up the trans ban, which happened last week. President Trump tweeted out that he would prohibit transgender individuals to serve in any capacity in the U.S. military, and said our military must focus on decisive and overwhelming victory and can't be burdened with tremendous medical costs and disruptions that transgenders in the military would entail. First of all, what are the medical costs to which Trump is referring, and do you think the Pentagon has any wiggle room in its budget?
Yeah, the medical costs, there have been two recent studies done, and there's actually an ongoing study that the Defense Department is trying to continue to see what the costs are, and not just the costs in terms of medical care, but efficiency of troops and all of that. But two studies over the past couple of years that came out, and but each of them found that it would be a modest rounding error in the Pentagon's health budget, a healthcare budget, to help people maintain either a transition or to begin one. It's not even clear how many trans people are in the military, but it's the low estimate is somewhere like around 1,200. The high estimate is around 11,000 or 12,000. So we're talking about a very small number of people who would be affected by this. But it's also more important, the transgender ban was announced in a tweet. I mean, it was not even a one-page press release or anything, and it just kind of came out of the blue. The Secretary of Defense was actually on vacation. The Joint Chiefs of Staff had not been briefed or anything like that. And so, again, this is something where even, Trump diehards should be upset that their president does not seem to even be good at kind of selling his own policies among the people who are going to have to implement them. And there was a lot of speculation in the press, which seems pretty well-founded, that the reason he was doing that is because there was a spending bill on the table in the House that had money for his wall with Mexico in it, and that this was seen as a sop to social conservatives who were also in favor of a Mexico wall, so that it was kind of a quid pro quo for that, because actually during the campaign, and this is to Trump's credit, he consistently said he didn't really give a shit about the transgender issue or about bathroom bans, that he was not actually kind of marching to the tune that many conservative Republicans do.
So it is a somewhat cynical political maneuver rather than evidence of transphobia. although it would appear that he is happy to accommodate transphobic people in order to score political points. Just on a
But I mean, in fairness to him, that's also true. You know, the way liberals talk about it, you know, Obama was never against gay marriage. So, you know, but he was actually
nor Hillary Clinton, everyone.
So, you know, it's hard to say, but it's, you know, the one thing you can say about Trump from a Republican point of view is that he's constantly castigated for being kind of closetly socially liberal. Ted Cruz tried to kneecap him by asserting that the Donald believed in New York values, which apparently meant, you know, not making fun of gay people and Latinos and things like that. And it backfired on Ted Cruz. And, you know, more power to Trump if he is actually socially tolerant. It would be nice to hear him actually talk in those terms explicitly.
I think his position hopefully will evolve, right? This is what we get to do now, yeah. Is you can sort of play the political expedience card for as long as it's useful, and then ta-da, here's what I...
Although it is worth always pointing out that the Republican Party doesn't believe in evolution, so he'll have to use punctuated equilibrium or ethical Lamarckism or something, yeah.
the giraffe stretch its neck. Yeah, I'd like that. That'd be for some good political cartoons.
We should pause and talk about the amazing sort of sub-story of those trans ban tweets, which was the gap between the first tweet and the second tweet. I don't know if you guys sort of followed that sub-kerfuffle, but the idea that, you know, this first tweet says, after consultation with my generals and military experts, please be advised that the United States government will not accept or allow, and then there's a, like, five-dot ellipsis. And then that was at 8:55, and we don't hear again from the president until 9:04. And the already developed urban legend, at the very least, is that a bunch of people in the Pentagon were like, oh, shit, we're going to war, probably with, I don't know, North Korea, right? I mean, there's a lot of ways that sentence can end. And given that no one had heard anything about plans to announce a ban on trans service members, it's logical to guess that that might have been a major national security moment. The idea that we now are so far into it, so deep into it, that we're like, yeah, maybe the president's just going to declare war on Twitter, shows that things may be a little more off-kilter.
That might put the Twitter IPO back on the table, too. You know, it'll be the first social media platform to, you know, be used to start a world war. That would be kind of cool.
Never mind congressional approval. It's like, do you have the blue check mark?
This is also a sign, even though it's the move itself was petulant and terrible and badly done, and essentially threatens to pull the rug out under existing trans troops who Obama administration allowed to come out without repercussions. All that is true.
By the way, only in the last year of his presidency, by the
correct.
Way. So it's, again, this is, you know, Obama had more battlefield conversions than, you know, Constantine, it seems.
It's a sign of how small, end of that final Revenge of the Sith scene amount, sliver of land above the lava is left among stupid anti-gay culture wars. It's people squabbling over bathrooms in North Carolina and whether transgendered troops can serve openly or non-openly in the military compared to, you know, Bill Clinton signed into law the Defense of Marriage Act just 20 years ago, which was an amazing, amazing kind of prohibition, preventative prohibition that Reason and other people, you know, criticized at the time. But that was pretty mainstream two-party politics. Karl Rove in 2004 thought it would be a great idea to encourage the maximum number of states to put on their ballot measures for that November's election initiatives to outlaw gay marriage on the state level. And I think effectively in the short term helped George W. Bush's own politics. It was an incredibly cynical, but much more far-reaching move back then. All of that has been effectively undone, mostly by the culture and then laggardly by politicians sensing that the wind had blown decisively in the other direction. And so this move, which is terrible and bad, is at the same time, you know, it's significant for the people who it affects, and we should not poo-poo that. But it's also a sign of how much in complete retreat this thing that we, you know, 20 years ago, it was normal politics, Republican politics, to be against gay people adopting kids who were otherwise in foster homes. I mean, it's just nuts. And all of that has been lost in a rout, and all of that is good. So hopefully this is the last gasp of this style of stupid politics.
I just want to double check. The gays are the lava in that metaphor?
They're always the lava, Catherine. They're always the lava. Matt, to finish up your kind of historical perspective there, reading the tweet, it talks about how if we're to take Trump's tweet on face value, it says that, you know, medical cost and disruption are the big part of it. And it seems to me that disruption would indicate that there might be soldiers that dislike trans people or that don't want to serve with them. But I would think that same argument had probably been applied when we were integrating whites and blacks or when women became service members. If we had similar bumps within the military as we've integrated more and more groups into the army?
The problem here is that you have Trump and, again, Gorka, who was out there defending this thing in his harumphy style, saying, yeah, no more social engineering in the military, rough, 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 as if the man would have any idea of what has been going on in the military. This is kind of what happens when rookies come in from the outside and try to play politics with this this large organization. I mean, Nick was talking about the various institutions in American life that have lost all respect. The one that has maintained most of it has been the military. Part of this comes from an unhealthy point of view, which is that I think we're a little bit jock sniffy when it comes to people who carry guns in our name, whether they're cops or military. But part of it, I think, is also an accurate reflection of the professionalization of the military that's happened over the last three decades in the wake of the Vietnam debacle. And so the military was dealing with this stuff. They just were, you know, General Mattis and other people have been kind of putting on their hard hats and kind of working through the issues with this problem. And Trump's announcement kind of preempted all of that. They were in the process of learning and having discovery on this. And I don't, you know, it's not an exact equivalent to integrating the military, probably. I mean, there's just sex is different than skin color to some degree. But I think that they were finding that for the most part, it was kind of working out. And that there were studies being done, and Rand has the Rand Corporation has the definitive ongoing study, as Nick was pointing out before. So to root around all of that in the name of short-term politics is another indicator of kind of the unseriousness of these people.
Hey, Catherine, when we're talking about this kind of stuff, we're talking about something that has really, really big rhetorical panache and a lot of feelings in it, but not that big of a statistical punch. Caitlyn Jenner, who's who I get my statistics from, says that there are 1,500 transsexuals in the military. I think Nick brought up that it's somewhere between 1,200 and 12,000, depending. I'm curious, as a libertarian, I don't view the president as the father of the nation and the sage of sages and the embodiment of the will of the people and that kind of thing. I view him as a bureaucrat. But it would seem that much of Trump's presidency is a rhetorical one, and that is part of the reason why there's so much angry resonance with people that are socially tolerant or on the left with these kind of things he does. How much of the presidency should actually be rhetorical? How much of it should just be statements of values versus doing things that have effect?
I'm all for the fully rhetorical presidency. If the entire power of the executive branch was the bully pulpit, we'd probably all be better off. But unfortunately, that is not the case. And in particular, it's not the case with the military, right? I mean, we ask our president to be the commander in chief of the armed forces. We believe in civilian control of the military. And that comes with a bunch of very tricky baggage, including stuff like this, which is that, you know, Trump is the head of HR for the people defending our country. He is in charge of that. He can, in fact, do stuff like what he just did. Now, you know, his generals and some others are now saying, well, he can't really quite do it, and we're still thinking about it, and we'll get back to you. But that's, you know, that's just sort of a product of it takes a while to turn a big ship. He is within his proper role in the presidency of doing this. And I think, you know, this is something that is we don't like to think about it. We don't really like to think about the idea of this guy that we've elected in a suit and tie who sits behind a desk is also the guy who gets to tell millions of people with guns what to do. It doesn't sit nicely with our idea of ourselves as a civilized, modern, sort of polite society and country. But the fact is, much of what the U.S. government does is ultimately backed by the existence of the U.S. military. And I think it's of course true that the number of trans people serving is small relative to the larger population. I've been very interested to hear the statistic that keeps getting cited over and over, that a higher percentage of the trans population serves than the general population, that there seems to be some kind of affinity there. I don't quite know what to make of that number, and it strikes me also possibly as fake news for reasons that should be obvious. It is very, very hard to have the number of trans people in the general population as well as to know the number of trans people in the armed forces, since it would be quite reasonable of those trans people not to have come out even after Obama gave them the okay to do so, precisely because they might fear something like this happening. So I don't think we know, but I do find it interesting, this idea that there may be even a disproportionate number of people in service right now. I wish that it were true that we could say, either this is just a totally separate thing and we do not use it for social engineering, or yes, this is a vehicle for social engineering, and in fact, we are using this large employer, our status, the U.S. government status as a large employer to shape the world that we live in. In fact, it is a messy, muddled through version of both, which is inevitable given the hybrid.
And I mean,
If I can add a historical note that is pretty interesting, and I've been reading a fair amount of books about the civil rights era or the end of Jim Crow which can in most accounts or many accounts is time to the Brown versus Board of Education ruling by the Supreme Court in 1954, which ended segregated public schools around the country. But a lot of that was forced by the fact that black men were not able to serve in combat operations in World War II, and they came back from Europe and the Pacific and elsewhere, having served their country, having been treated absolutely as second class citizens, if not worse, through a lot of that, and also at various points putting their lives at risk, but then not being able to actually participate fully in American life, and that was one of the main kind of contributors to the strong push for civil rights that began in the early 50s, if not before, and also led to Harry Truman, who was not particularly good on race issues, but it also led him to integrate the troops for during the Korean War. So that, you know, you want to say always, well, the military, you know, we recognize that in certain kind of safety professions and in certain types of government jobs that, you know, regular rules of society are not going to apply. But it's always interesting to look at how oftentimes the justifications for maintaining retrograde social practices or, you know, institutions in the armed forces or in government or, you know, in a special part of our economy lives end up actually fueling the very changes that are being withheld from those things. So, and as Matt was talking about, it is pretty fascinating. I mean, 20 years from the Defense of Marriage Act to a conversation like this is pretty bracing, especially if you're in favor of individuals being able to express themselves and express their lifestyles, individual lifestyles publicly. Of course, 20 years is way too late for a lot of people, and you know, you want change automatically. But it's always fascinating to kind of think about what went into those culture shifts between, you know, say, Bill Clinton ardently defending, you know, the Defense of Marriage Act and saying that he believed that a marriage could only be between one woman and one man, to where we are now. And it's, you know, it's hard to figure out exactly all of that goes, all of what contributed to a very different state of affairs. And I think in most ways, culturally and socially, a much more libertarian world where people are allowed to kind of fly their freak flags. And by freak flag, I mean whether you're heterosexual or homosexual or transgender or whatever. I mean, it's just people are much more comfortable with highly speciated expressions of personal identity.
Like normcore over here. I'm rocking serious normcore in Alsatz.
I don't know what any of that meant.
Please never say that.
I think it meant that it meant Riesling, which is one of the signature wines of that area. That's what it means.
So taking a step to a specific service member who is now a veteran and a member of the Senate, John McCain, he had a kind of House of Cards level drama go down in the Senate last week. In his personal life, he's been diagnosed with a brain tumor and is undergoing treatment this week and also had it removed last week. But he came to the Senate in order to vote on the Senate's health care plan and to allow it to come to the floor, only to strike it down along with Senators Murkowski and Collins. So, Matt, I think you're our resident McCain buff. Can you walk us through this Shakespearean episode that happened?
What's great about it is that no matter what he would have voted on Friday, was it, or Thursday, everyone would have said, see, that just proves what I've said all along about John McCain. But I think I have a better take on that or claim to that than most somehow. John McCain has always liked to be the center of attention and the center of drama. He put his vote, he placed it last. In that process, he told reporters going forward, when they asked him, how are you going to vote? He said, no, just watch, wait for the show, all this kind of stuff. Famously, obviously, Donald Trump very early in the campaign said about John McCain, I prefer, people, heroes who weren't shot down, never apologized for it from McCain's point of view. McCain said that he wished that he wanted him to apologize to all POWs, since there are quite a few, obviously during the Vietnam War, and Trump, as he does almost with everything, just kind of shrugged it off. And so you had this personal animus between the two. McCain never really endorsed him and has, in many senses, at least one of them very good, and at least one of them, I think, poor. Donald Trump represents the kind of anti-McCain. McCain is alarmed by Trump's sense of foreign policy. That's in part because McCain is probably the biggest and most influential hawk in American public life, even more so than Hillary Clinton on this. McCain wants Bosnia and Ukraine and Georgia and God knows who else to join NATO. And is just constantly belligerent there. And so he sees Trump's comparative disinterest in nation building and going off on foreign adventures, and also his relationship with Vladimir Putin to be incredibly troubling. And then McCain is driven by this sense of honor, which he will be the first to admit, or at least the second to admit, that he constantly falls short of. But he's sort of driven by this haunted notion that you should do better for America, and you should put your own personal ambitions, which have always been huge in his case, you should still subsume them in the greater cause of American public service and greatness in the American project. So this all fits in. His objection ultimately is procedural, and that is a good objection as far as I am concerned to the way that the skinny repeal or any kind of revamp of Obamacare has been done. It's been done. Every single process objection that Republicans had against the Democrats' very poorly handled ramming through of Obamacare back in 2009, 2010, the Republicans, I think, have done on its face much worse, like almost no open hearings. They came within an eyelash of just passing a bill that no one had really even read or contemplated or discussed in any way. They, I think, finished writing it that morning for breakfast or lunch. It's insane to do business this way, which people who are honest would say, even though some of those people who were voting for it, including your Mike Lees of the world and Rand Paul's. So McCain's objection to it was more about that and wanting to go and saying you have to go through the normal Senate process. I'm sure he relished the opportunity to stick it back into Donald Trump's face. But at the same time, doing so in, by his own lights, in the face of a pretty considerable physical courage, which he's always had in excess of, considering all the stuff that he's gone through, to go there and make this dramatic gesture in a way, like most of his dramatic gestures have done throughout his entire career, guaranteed to maximize the applause among Beltway journalists, who he famously has called over the decades his base, because McCain never had a conservative Republican base, especially in Arizona. They hate him. His base have been national journalists in Washington, D.C. He performed for them majestically last week. I hope that he didn't run for re-election back in 2016. If I was him, I would have dropped the mic at that moment and gone off in the sunset and tried to battle cancer. I'm sure he won't, because he can't ever unclench power. But it was a purely McCain-tastic display. But ultimately, I think did something that which needed to be done, which is stop the charade of pretending that this was a bill that that people were actually going to pass, or that was actually going to be a good idea.
Can I play devil's advocate for a moment on this? My understanding of the bill was that it was to repeal Obamacare, and even then to do it 2 years hence, so that, you know, they would repeal it, get everybody on board with that, and then once that was out of the way, come up with what was going to replace it. Am I reading that correctly?
As far as I know, it's kind of difficult in this farmhouse to figure out what this hour's version of Obamacare was. But yeah, the skinny repeal was a punt that keeps together some of the essential parts of Obamacare while jettisoning some others.
Okay. Nick, how come Rand Paul and Mike Lee voted on this? I would think that I was surprised that McCain was the deciding factor here. There was a sort of weird alliance going on between the moderates of the Republican Party, like Murkowski and like Collins, and the more ideologue type people like Lee and Rand. I sort of thought he was going to continue being a stickler, but he and Lee ended up voting on it. Do you know why?
Well, I think that they, you know, at the end of the day, you got to vote for any kind of repeal that you can get. And I think that that's what was motivating them. And also that some of the moderate Republicans were bothered by various things that would happen anyway. So to me, that's not so much of a surprise, that Mike Lee and Rand Paul would vote to repeal Obamacare in some fashion. I think the larger question and ultimately the more serious one is, why didn't the Republican Party have a plan in place, given all of the time they had to prepare one that could pass both the House and the Senate? And they were able to do it with a simple majority in the Senate, partly because of the procedural stuff that McCain was grandstanding on. But, you know, that ultimately is the question, because the Republicans control, at least through the midterms, they control the House and the Senate and the White House. They should be able to get something done if they were serious about it. And I mean, I think you have to conclude at this point that most of that party, which ran as, you know, the anti-Obamacare party, is simply not interested in fixing healthcare. And by fixing it, I mean moving it more in a market-oriented direction where individuals are both responsible and able to purchase their own insurance as they see fit. You know, there's just very little evidence that these guys are actually moving anywhere in that direction.
Well, so since the repeal effort failed, is Obamacare the ongoing law of the land? Is that what we have, Catherine?
I think so. I mean, this is reasons Peter Suderman is to be believed, the healthcare debate will never be over. We will just be in it forever in some sort of, you know, eternal, mirror hall of horrors. But I think we're going to give it a rest for a little while now. This was pretty definitive as far as these things go. Apparently, tax reform is the thing we're going to do next. I assume the tax reform debate will look just like the healthcare reform debate, which is to say Republicans will not have a very good, detailed, well thought out plan. It will be demagogued as the rich versus the poor. There will be a bunch of increasingly stupid and diluted versions of the legislation, which will eventually not pass and or pass in some form that will just kick the can down the road and we'll do it all again in a year or 2 years or 10 years. I think we're done for the minute. But, you know, the idea that John McCain's sort of riding in on the white horse and setting to rest this question, that's going to be the story about this, misses so much, because it isn't about John McCain at all. It isn't even really about the odd little moderate coalition. It isn't about the Liberty Caucus giving in. It's about the fact that healthcare in this country and health insurance in particular in this country is so broken that even the best intentioned, highly educated technocrats all working together with the best goodwill probably couldn't have solved this problem. And these assholes absolutely had no chance.
Yeah, I'm pretty skeptical of all those technocrats. I've been reading up on Canadian healthcare and on a few other countries' healthcare, and they tend to be a lot more localized than what people are calling for. The sort of gigantic national top-down solution that I'm not sure that exists in that many countries, and I don't think we could work it out on ours. But okay, so it's an ongoing thing. So I should, you know, keep reading on healthcare and writing tweets about healthcare jokes in order to stay relevant.
Laughter is also the best medicine.
Andrew. Right.
Yeah, that's right. But the copay
and
is
the
a
only
killer,
medicine
and
we
there
can
is
now
a lifetime
afford.
Cap on jokes. So
no, that's okay. I mean, I just negotiate with the insurance company and so much money. To shift over to tweets, a federal judge in Virginia has ruled that politicians blocking followers on social media constitutes a violation of their freedom of speech. I haven't read the case, but my understanding of it is that a public official had blocked a critical constituent from her Facebook page. And the reasoning goes that because the Facebook page was being used as an official platform of her office, that by doing so, she was revoking his First Amendment right to access it. This is at a district level, so this will probably go on and be taken to a court of appeals and that sort of thing. But it does set an interesting precedent in that it is indicative of social media being a right that you have and not just a right to say things on social media, but to access the platforms therein that you want. Matt, you've brought up Sebastian Gorka a couple of times in the podcast, and it's my understanding that he has blocked you. So what is the situation there, and are you taking part in this glorious freedom of speech debate?
Yeah, you know, I thought that this sounded absurd on its face, obviously, that this has been any kind of a First Amendment free speech thing until about 4 days ago when I saw that Seb blocked me, and now I think that I'm a First Amendment martyr. I'm going to get like an army of Pope hats to represent me. It's actually kind of irritating to be blocked by someone who's drawing any kind of government salary and feels kind of wrong. Jacob Sullum wrote a good piece about this for us 5, 6, 7 days ago that I recommend people read because it's by Jacob Sullum, and so it's incredibly careful and detailed. And his conclusion, which I will probably bastardize, is that it's surprisingly meritorious to at least examine the issues, that it's more complicated than the first kind of laugh reflex that you might have. And kind of in the way that you set up, Andrew, of that, hey, look, this is, I want to be able to look and see what this asshole is saying, since he is a prominent at this point, Trump government spokesman. He's trotted out there to be one of his lead apologists whenever there's a particularly bad bit of week of news out there, which is basically every week. And so, you know, it's kind of hard for me to do my job. I still kind of smirk at the notion of it. And I should mention that he blocked me within like 6 weeks of handing me his business card. So he's blocked me on Twitter, but I can call him on his cell phone. So I think that's what that's I'm probably going to do.
The second the podcast ends, you're going to just text him some angry things that you would have said on tweets and make his life worse. Well, so I look at this, and again, I haven't gone through all the legalities of it, but I mean, one thing that strikes me is that Twitter is not a public utility. It's a private platform, and that our participation in it is voluntary. So is that something that should be taken into effect, Catherine?
Yeah, I mean, I am sympathetic to the fact that Matt doesn't know how to use technology and so might not know this clever workaround. But of course, if someone's Twitter feed is public and they block you, all you have to do to see their tweets is log in another browser or log out of your Twitter account and then go to their page. Right. This is This is not exactly the same
as
what we might
That's
think
totally
of as traditional
awesome.
Incursions
you.
On free speech. And I suspect Matt actually knows that.
He
but,
obviously had no idea. Yeah, he may have blocked himself
yeah,
from
so,
following Gorka.
He probably blocked himself. No, but this actually gets to the larger question of this weird pretense that free speech means speech on all platforms, heard by all people and done by all people at all times, which is not what free speech means. And moreover, the idea that that we have somehow a right to be on, as you say, this is not a public utility. It's a private site, and people can control whoever sees and whoever responds to them in what is essentially a private forum. It's the same as being in your house. Now, it's a house with like no walls, and
there's lava.
There's a giant mob gathered outside or something. So the metaphor fails in a Welshian proportions there. There's lava.
One hopes
there's lava
that your
around the house,
household and has more revenue than Twitter on a reliable basis as well.
I'm pretty sure it does, actually. Yeah. But yeah, I mean, this is broadly speaking the same type of argument you hear when people say, you know, I have a right to be heard on the stage of a private club, or I have the right to speak in the comments section of a privately owned website, or I have the right to be heard on cable news. None of those things are true. You have no such right. And the fact that people are confused about that is ultimately, I think, quite detrimental to the defense of real free speech, which is your right to say what you believe in a public forum.
Are you going to blame it all on the need for school choice and hence better K-12 education about the Constitution, Catherine? I could see it's a hop, skip, and a jump away.
I was not going to, though also yes, that.
What I was going to suggest, though, is, and, you know, this issue, these are kind of marginal issues, right? I don't think it's, you know, the fate of the Republic hangs on this. Very much, if only because the Republic probably died sometime in the early 1790s anyway. But one of the things is I agree with both Matt and Catherine that you don't necessarily have a right to comment or whatever. If somebody was using a public forum and blocking people from being able to read it, which, of course, is not the case here, to their utterances, to me, that strikes me as a different issue, because that would be like saying, hey, I'm going to have a town hall meeting in your hometown. I represent you, but you're not allowed in the door. You're not allowed to listen peacefully. And that strikes me as problematic. I don't know how far I would take that argument, but we do recognize that public officials limit their free speech rights and free speech protections, actually, by entering public office in various ways. So it may well be that, when it comes to social media, even if they're technically private, if they're being used to exercise their office, they might come under a different set of laws and regulations than if they were actually private citizens.
Yeah, I mean, I really disagree with that, actually. I think the idea that just because you sometimes use a particular platform to communicate with the public and because you wield some sort of power, the contours of your free speech rights and also your ability to speak privately, that they change is, we have some specific ways that's true that are codified in law. And unless we want to make a pretty big change in our understanding of public and private speech, I don't see how we could do that.
Yeah, do you think
with social media? It's a dick move to be the president of the United States and block people from Twitter.
I mean, but
Twitter.
Do you
like,
think that certain
true,
sunset
but,
or sunset sunshine laws and other things put mandate you certain a lack of privacy if you're a public employee? In most states in the country, there's a place where your salary is publicly published. Actually, even in nonprofits, if you're an officer of a nonprofit foundation that gets a tax exempt status, certain private facts of your life are in the public record. I'm not sure how far I want to push it. But these exceptions exist, and that may well flood into something like Twitter.
And I actually think frequently those exceptions are problematic as well. I mean, I'm thinking here of pretty much all campaign finance law, which is driven by this underlying notion that there are places where we restrict people's privacy when they do when they interact with the political sphere. And I think that's, if anything, exactly backwards. One reason that we protect both free speech and privacy is so that people can exercise their political speech most fully in the way that they choose.
Yeah, I agree. I'm against disclosure, mandatory disclosure laws, particularly in a country that was in many ways fundamentally built upon anonymous political speech. The idea that you would have to make your contributions public is problematic. And we've written at various times and in various places about how public records about campaign donations are used to go after people by the very people that they were trying to oust from office. Having said that, politicians and public figures, I think there's something. There's a weird wrinkle in this conception that is a little bit different, and it may be just, I would say this in a political campaign contribution setting. I don't think disclosure of donors should be mandatory in any way, shape, or form, but you're probably not going, but you could then punish politicians by saying, you're not going to vote for anybody who doesn't disclose. And it might be the same thing with political figures.
And I think that we can absolutely do that with Twitter to say, I would love it if someone runs a campaign ad in the next cycle, like, hi, I'm Sarah and Donald Trump blocked me from his Twitter. Hi, I'm Fred and Donald Trump blocked me from his Twitter. Right.
Yeah. He blocked me. Can we really live in a world where the president
wrong for
blocks
Twitter,
you on Twitter?
Wrong for America.
Or Mumble. Or keeps, before Club Penguin went out of business, I think he wasn't letting certain people in igloos. And for anybody who has kids of a certain age, they'll know exactly what Club Penguin was.
Is that that
more until we join you,
underage,
Club Penguin?
Underage sex club in the Caribbean, or am I confusing some stories?
Yeah, it was a Disney.
It's in the back of a pizza restaurant.
It was a Disney-based social media platform for kids where you could safely go. And pretty much. Disney was one of the first companies to offer full benefits to same-sex couples. So, yeah, you know where that leads, Matt.
To go back to our resident free speech martyr and Sebastian Gorka arch nemesis, Matt Welch, do you think with Twitter, with conversations about constitutionality and freedom of speech, is Twitter just the latest platform by which we're dealing with old rights, or has it done anything fundamental to the landscape that should be dealt with differently when we discuss legalities?
Internet, it kind of it poses some slightly new wrinkles on stuff. Usually there's a dazzle, there's a flash bomb that goes off when something is new, whether it's the internet, whether it's hacking, whether it's the dark web, and there are the initial martyrs that get in front of people's sense of panic and the way that panic clouds them from noticing that 90% of the discussions or 95% of the discussions are the same as they ever were. It's just a somewhat different universe, but it is different somewhat your ability to broadcast everywhere and interact with people everywhere. It poses its own challenges. I mean, I think this is a dumb example, but in the way that high school kids' sense of free speech has been somewhat limited, they can get punished by Facebook posts because they could be perceived as a threat. Is that on-campus speech? Is that off-campus speech? It's just those are kinds of questions that didn't come up nearly in the same way in the era of flyers and zines and people talking trash at the AMPM parking lot.
If I can point out, though, that the Bong Hits for Jesus case settled a few years ago against expanding the scope of free speech for students, that was a guy holding a sign at an event that he had been encouraged to attend by the school. It was not in any way, shape, or form a school function, but he got in trouble for the Bong Hits for Jesus poster with the school, and the Supreme Court said, yeah, that's okay, because while you don't surrender all of your speech rights at the schoolhouse door, you somehow surrender most of them. real and imagined.
And we're against that too,
yeah,
right?
So even that is kind of like a Facebook post. Yeah.
No, it's interesting. I mean, we live in an era when the Supreme Court is, for the most part, doing the best job it ever has by expanding free speech and cementing and protecting those areas. But they have a couple of little weak spots, and one of them definitely has to do with school. Another definitely has to do with national security. And I think this is going to eventually bleed over into what's also being kind of sussed out at the Supreme Court level soon, which is third party doctrine stuff. So the Fourth Amendment and the First Amendment are going to bleed. Who has the rights to your information in the cloud? Does the government really have the right to read all of your emails after they've 6 months after they've been written? That's kind of the de facto reality that we live in. I can't see how that survives a challenge, but it comes up with all these kinds of areas. So even though we have this great protection, there are these blind spots, and securities law and campaign finance law are two obvious other ones. And trademark too. We got to fight all that. Screw them.
I'd like to move on to a final and pressing topic for the podcast, which is that over the weekend, I think, Donald Trump suggested that he would make a fine addition to Mount Rushmore, which has been going over about as you'd suspect, with a lot of aghast pearl clutching, although I think that was probably a joke. I doubt anyone on the podcast right now is in favor of adding him to Mount Rushmore. But Nick, if you could pick someone to add to Mount Rushmore, who would it be?
Cochise.
Who is Cochise? For those of us that are
Indian
millennials.
Chief. It was an Indian chief who fought against the United States government.
Oh, okay.
And there's also Sitting Bull, I believe, who is not all that far away from Mount Rushmore, by which I mean that he's somewhere in one of the Dakotas and or the northern half of Canada, but there's a statue in process of him. I think Trump was absolutely joking in this context, and he has a terrible sense of humor, but so do most of the rest of the people following him. And I wish Mount Rushmore is one of the greatest disappointing national monuments in existence. So I just, I welcome the day when it is so weathered that people don't remember it. And I'll also bring up a very quick story that supposedly a young Cher passing it said that it was quite amazing that that mountain looked like four presidents. And that always gets filed under the too good to check, too good to check stories. But
Matt, you're laughing in the background. Who would you put on Mount Rushmore?
It's more like who would you take off first through jackhammers, and I think Teddy Roosevelt would probably be the first to go for me. Just enough of him, he's the everyone on the right likes to point to Woodrow Wilson as the godfather of awful progressive movement, but it was Teddy Roosevelt if we're really being honest. Super big expansionist, total racist. His History of the White Peoples, I believe it's called, the several volume series, starts off with a paean to why the success of the Aryan race is the single most important factor of American life. So he was out rocking the alt-right before the right had to get alt, and this sense of the Eastern swell who is going to prove his manliness by lying about physical exertions haunts us still, I think, in this day and age. And enough already with these people.
Catherine, would you add anybody, or are you in the Matt blow it all up camp?
I think we should just go ahead and put both Kid Rock and The Rock on there. Just call it a day. It's kind of thematic. Likely one of them will be one of our future presidents.
This conversation does spark a memory that I had of, if any of you have gone to a Washington Nationals baseball game, you know that for the mid-game festivity, they have foam-headed presidents run around the stadium. And if you pick the right president who's going to win, and it's like Washington, Jefferson, Teddy Roosevelt, and they added William Henry Harrison or something, who always has a heart attack in the first 30 seconds of the race. But I was thinking it isn't William Henry. I forget who they added.
Is that
but
true?
It's,
That's
maybe
the best
it's a
thing
Roosevelt
I've ever heard.
In a wheelchair. That would be pretty cool. But my My dream is actually that, to make it an interesting race, is that they let the four presidents go, and then midway through they release presidential assassins and who try to chase them down. And if they, whoever they tackle, you know, loses the race.
But what if Hinckley gets them? Like, do they?
Yeah, John Hinckley Jr.
But then do they?
Well, you know,
they still win.
I think we all win. So I don't know. You know. I haven't worked out all the bugs. I'm just throwing it out there. Look, I'm a big idea guy. I'm not a detail guy.
Heaton, please end this podcast. Save
through
us.
20 plus years of public writing. Yeah. You know, it's like.
Yeah, I'm not even going to bother with my cool Mount Rushmore ideas. I'll save it for another time. I'm too enraptured with a whole assassins on the field as a mascot thing. Well, thank you, guys. My mind has expanded, whether I like it or not, having had this discussion. Thank you for listening.
If you, Andrew, if you put it in a dryer at low heat for 20 minutes, it'll shrink back size.
Oh, nice. Good.
And you'll only lose a little bit of the elasticity in the waistband.
And the wrinkles will go out. It'll just be nice and smooth. Thank you for listening on your end, listeners. You've been listening to The Reason Podcast. You can check us out on iTunes. Please rate and review us while you're there. And come back and enjoy The Reason Podcast, your conduit to a cleaner, smaller American government.